Good evening, everyone. This is Pam Thack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Happy Thanksgiving and Gratitude Day weekend, everyone. I hope you enjoyed your holiday with family and friends, and that you are as grateful as I am to have you here. Thank you. Kicking off this week is international best-selling author Tess Gerritsen. If you haven't heard about Tess, you must be living under a rock someplace. She is the writer of the books that created the Rizzoli and Isles series, among other books. She's won practically every award there is. She's an incredibly talented woman, and I'm so honored to have her with me. Tess Gerritsen, welcome to Authors on the Air.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you, Tess. I want to start off by saying that I don't know how often people ask you about this, but you have started a foundation to fund the Scripps Institute for Alzheimer's research. Is that correct?
I had several fundraisers to donate money to Scripps Institute. I think they are, when it comes to biological research, and in particular research for Alzheimer's, I think that they are one of the foremost institutes in the country.
Why did you choose Alzheimer's research?
Well, my father died with it, and unfortunately, I'm seeing it in the parents of many of my contemporaries, all struggling with our parents, who are, they're losing their memories, and we're losing their personalities as time goes by, and I think there's a lot of also fear among us that we're next, that our generation is going to be coming down with it soon, and I live in terror of it, because for those of us who use our brains, who work with intellectual property, it's a pretty frightening thing that you won't be able to use that most important tool you have.
I think you're right. It is scary, and especially because we're not sure, or maybe we are now, that it is a hereditary condition. And so far, not a lot of anything has come out of it other than some drugs that may or may not slow down the advancement. Isn't that true?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think there's any drug that you can say this is going to slow it down definitively.
Yeah.
And a lot of the drugs, they say, well, you've got to start it early before the symptoms start. But, I don't want to to get to the
point
where I have
Alzheimer's. You don't want to medicate if you don't have to. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Or get to the point where you have it and then it turns out the drug is no good because you started too late. So I would love to see something that could reverse it, and something that we can take on a truly preventive basis. Now, right now, all we have going for us is lifestyle changes. I mean, there are some behaviors that seem to be correlated with later onset of Alzheimer's. We can delay it a little bit by exercise, by not becoming obese, by controlling diabetes and hypertension. But other than that, I don't know what else to do.
Yeah, those are kind of the things that we should be doing anyway for all types of diseases that we are susceptible to, especially as we age. But interesting. When you practiced medicine, and for those of you who don't know that Tess is a fully licensed MD, now retired from practice, what was your specialty?
Internal medicine. So I saw essentially older people, and I didn't do surgery. And it just really had to do with a lot of cancer, hypertension, and Alzheimer's, and a lot of, I guess I would say metabolic diseases.
Yes. I love my internal medicine guy, by the way. So I'm grateful for that. He kind of is my go-to guy for managing my medical life. So it's an important specialty and one all of us should have as adults, for sure. Which came first, the writing or the medicine? And which enhanced the other the most?
I knew I wanted to be a writer when I was 7. I've been reading Nancy Drew, and I wanted to tell my own mystery stories. And I told my father, that's what I'm going to be. And he said, that's no way to make a living. So he convinced me to go into science. And I was already interested in science. So I went to medical school. But it was during maternity leave from the hospital when I decided I was going to get back to writing again. So I wrote my first book on maternity leave. And luckily, I had a son who slept long hours of naps. You know, he was
yes.
very cooperative. And after selling a couple of books, I realized I can make a living as a writer. So as to what enhanced the other, I would say definitely becoming a doctor enhanced the writing, because it opened worlds to me that turned out to be pretty fascinating to my readers.
I bet it did. I want to talk about this new book because I'm fascinated by I Know a Secret, because this one explores mother relationships. And what I noted, though, and I wanted to talk to you specifically about Mara's mother, because she is a serial
mm-hmm.
killer.
Yes.
And that is so unusual to have a female serial killer. How did
it
you...
Is.
Yeah, what did you have to do in the way of making it a believable, credible story? Because there's so little on female serial killers.
Well, what I've discovered about female serial killers is a lot of them do it for practical reasons. They don't, they don't do it for sexual thrills. They don't do it for power. They do it because they want to make a buck. They're doing it for really logical reasons. And that is why Mora's mother did it. She was part of this ring that would kill pregnant women and take their fetuses and sell these babies, these newborn babies on the baby market. So that made her a little different from most of your male serial killers. She just did
mm-hmm.
it for the bucks, and that was truly evil. It was, there was
yes.
no passion involved. There was no there was no sexual
right
side
which is kind of
this.
It kind of drives male serial killers, but not female.
Right. Yeah. They tend to be more sexual thrills kind of guys, but she just did it because she was there to make a living.
It's just scary. You know, it's just really scary when you think that there are people like that. And I think you're right that there are probably, a lot more female serial killers than we even are aware of. And that's kind of a scary thing. Because,
well, and they go about it. They go about it in different ways. They poison.
Right.
I think a lot of them are poisoners. A lot of them actually are serial killers of their own children. I mean, you see a lot of women who've killed multiple babies. Somehow they get overwhelmed by having children or they don't want this baby, and there will be multiple newborns that they've killed. So it's a very different pattern from men.
Wow. Well, and that scares me too. I mean, that's, you don't want to see that. I mean, let's be serious. You don't want to see that. That's not a fun thing to know about. But I think you're right. I think a lot of babies that are probably at one time were considered stillborn were really probably victims at their mother's own hand. So, and that's a
yeah.
sad thing. How much research did you do when you decided to write this particular book?
There was we're talking also about some other themes that happened in the story.
Yes.
And one of them had to do with false memory syndrome. That was a big part of the story. Mm-hmm. And another part of the story had to do with the satanic ritual abuse panic that happened in the 80s and 90s.
Yes.
The story was in large part inspired by something that really happened in my hometown. I grew up in San Diego. And there was a news article that I read a couple years later after this all happened about a man named Dale Akiki. He was born with a congenital abnormality, so he looked a little funny. He was an odd-looking man. But he was a devout churchgoer, and he taught Sunday school in this church. And for a couple of years, the kids loved him. Everybody was happy. And then one day, one of the mothers called the police and said, "I'm sure he's sexually molesting my son." And the police went about this investigation all wrong. They asked the parents to talk to their kids and find out if their kid had been sexually molested. These are 3 and 4 year old kids.
The
parents would ask their kids, huh?
Isn't that kind of not the way to do an investigation?
That's not the way to do the investigation.
I didn't think so.
The parents, I know. So the parents would ask their children, and 3 and 4 year olds after a while would say, "Yeah, that happened." So Mr. Kiki was arrested, and he spent, I believe, 20 months in prison awaiting trial. And the stories they got out of these kids were ridiculous. I mean, he was teaching these children during a 1 to 2 hour church service while the parents were right down the hall. And the kid said, oh, he took us out on a boat. He killed a shark. He killed a giraffe. He killed babies. Yeah, just outrageous stories.
That's one of the markers for something happening with a child, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, children, well, at that age, they're very, very young children, but they also have fantasies. Sure. They also aren't entirely clear about things that happen. But he went to, he went to trial based on a lot of these absurd stories, and luckily was declared innocent by the jury after the jury saw the videotaped interviews of the children and realized these were very leading questions they were asked. And then only later did they find out that the original accusation came from a mother who was mentally ill. So this was one story that came out of San Diego, and I thought, wow, this is amazing. At least the man got out. But around the country in that same period of time, there were similar trials happening, similar cases of a lot of them were, daycare centers where whole families were put into jail because
yes,
one mother
I
said
remember
that.
That. Yeah.
Yeah,
I remember that. Didn't
California?
They just, they released them after a long time, didn't they?
Right. And they were very long trials. And again, it's the same pattern where they talk to very young kids who told ridiculous stories, and one of them was, oh, he flew around on a broom and he killed a tiger. And they yet the prosecutors decided to push these trials forward. So I was looking at this and thought, what happens 20 years later after these kids grow up? What if these kids are now going to be, start to get murdered? And who's doing it? Why would you kill the witnesses that accidentally sent an innocent man to prison? And that was the basis for the story.
And interestingly enough, those witnesses really had no way of knowing that they were saying anything wrong. They were innocent.
No.
They were innocent, right. Yeah. Very interesting. Really fascinating. I know that we're on a limited time, but I want to talk to you about the television show, and I know that you are not the script writer for that, but you had told me in the green room that you have indeed written scripts. What is the difference, and what do you like best, and what do you like best about script writing, and what do you like best about novel writing? Because there's a huge difference.
What I love about novel writing is that you are the boss. You know, what you say goes on the page. Now, your editor may suggest changes, but in the end, it's your decision. What I loved about script writing is that you tell a story very quickly. You get right down to the nitty-gritty immediately, and it's all told in dialogue. You don't have to spend a lot of time setting the scene, and you just get right down to what the story is about. So they're two different types of storytelling, but they have one similarity, that it's really all about character. It's about who these people are and what drives them, what moves them. And the other thing about screenwriting is that you are in a partnership with the actor. It's amazing how you can have a terrible script and an actor can still do a good job of turning that into a believable performance. But if you have the best script in the world and you have a bad actor, that it doesn't help,
Yeah, it's amazing. Do you want to continue to screenwrite? Would you like to attempt your hand at that again and go there again?
Oh, yeah. I would love to. I mean, right now we are in talks about a possible spinoff series for Rizzoli and Isles, in which Maura Isles would have a television show just focused on her. And, I've sort of written the first season's story arc for that show, and we'll see if it happens.
I am told that when you write scripts, it really makes a difference in your own novel writing because you write with a more sparingly. You recognize the economy of words being very, very important. Do you find that to be true?
Well, I think it puts more of my attention on dialogue, really. By focusing on scripts, you really think about, you know, how effective can I be with what this character says. The only problem is that with a screenplay, you just really have to, as I said, get down to business right away. You don't have a chance to develop secondary characters or subplots. I mean, that's the nice thing about novel writing is you just have this big sprawling canvas you can paint on, and a lot of room to expand and a chance to go in other directions that the screenplay may not give you the freedom to do.
Sure, that makes sense. I want to change the topic again because, as I said when I introduced you, that you're so talented and you have so many gifts, and I think it's lovely. You play piano quite beautifully. Do you still play?
I do, but yeah, I mean, just as for fun. I think
sure.
I probably do more of is I'm a really, you know, very amateur violinist. And what I love about the violin is that you can play with groups. We have every so often we'll have like a jam session in my house, and you never know who shows up, whether it's six fiddles or five guitars. But the point is we teach each other tunes by ear, and I think that's what I've really come to appreciate is being a musician purely by ear and getting away from the crutch of sheet music.
How fun is that? I mean, that's wonderful.
It is, yeah. Yeah, I think some of my best friends here are musicians, and it's what's great about it is that you don't even have to be very good. Everybody just loves being together and playing, no matter how bad we sound.
I think that's terrific. So you're an amateur violinist. Do you play any other music or instruments? Do you sing?
No, I do not sing, and you don't want to hear me sing. But violin and piano is it. And luckily, I can go back and forth. So if we're short a rhythm instrument, I just move piano. I can do that too. But I love Celtic music, and I'm sort of in an area of the country where we have a lot of people who are into Celtic music.
How lovely, Tess. Are any of your siblings or family members or offspring creative as the way you are?
My younger son is a filmmaker. He started off as being an excellent photographer, worked in New York City for a while, and then he came home to Maine. And he and I are making a film together right now. We're making a documentary film.
Really?
It's about... Yeah, it's a kind of a bizarre topic, and I know everyone goes, what? We're making a documentary film about the animal, the pig, and its history with the human race. Because I found it really fascinating when I was traveling in Turkey during Ramadan that you can't get bacon, you can't get pork. And I began to ask just began to ask around, why is pork forbidden in certain religions? What is the reason for this? What's the genesis of this? I mean, we have the practical explanations of, oh, it's all trichinosis. But I think the story is much more complicated than that. So we're tracking down this historical mystery that goes back 3,000 years about why pork was forbidden. And, it, you know, the answer may take us all the way back to ancient Egypt. It's a fascinating topic.
Wow, that is interesting. Now, your son is the filmmaker. Does he specialize in documentaries?
He did. He was doing short films. In fact, he's getting a lot of assignments now doing drone photography and doing cinematography right now. But he and I also we made a horror film a couple years ago, and together a feature horror film. And I think we're about to sign a distribution deal sometime in the next couple of weeks. So that was the other thing that was fun, was just working with him. He was the director, I was the screenwriter, and we brought in professional actors from New York and Los Angeles to play the parts.
How fun. That kind of must be feeding all of your creative bones everywhere. You have so much going on between the music, the film, writing, script writing. Are you now? You must also be a talented painter or something. You have to be in the creative arts. I'm certain you do that too. So, dish. Tell
I'm
me
a pretty
the truth.
Good cook. That's a pretty big good cook.
Good, but that's great. How lovely. What's next for you, Tess? Where are you off to? What are you doing? Are you writing more? Will we see another Tess book for Rizzoli and Isles, or will you do standalone?
Well, I'm not sure about another book with Rizzoli and Isles, but I'm finishing up a book right now. It's a ghost thriller. I don't know how to describe it except it's
a supernatural thriller, right?
Yes,
that's a haunted house. Kind of a supernatural.
Every woman who's ever lived in this house has died there. So, of course, my heroine happens to rent it for the summer. And anyway, it has to do with ghosts and Maine, the state of Maine.
Where else would you set it? I mean, that makes sense to me. My mom and dad were from New England, and yes, there were a lot of, and Maine is perfect for that type of a setting. How wonderful. I'm so thrilled that you're here, but before I let you go, can we play Final Five? It's five quick questions and five quick answers.
Okay.
Yeah? Yep, for the challenge?
Go ahead.
It's all about you, so there's no guessing, okay? No cheating.
Okay.
So what do you like to do for fun when you're not writing and doing all this creative stuff, which I'm sure is very nurturing to you as well, but what is your guilty little pleasure? What do you like to do for fun?
Eating out at restaurants. I love trying bizarre new foods and travel, and that is my biggest pleasure, is getting on a plane and going someplace I've never been before and sitting down at a restaurant and looking at a dinner and going, what the heck is that? Let me eat it.
So where would you like to go as a follow-up to that?
Well, we're booked for Barcelona at the end of January, and I'm looking forward to that. And I think, there's so many places I haven't been, and they're kind of like piling up on my list, and my bucket list.
Sure.
We were going to book for Madagascar. It's so funny. We were going to book for Madagascar next August until all the big article came out about how they have outbreaks of plague every August.
Sure.
So
right.
We decided, we'll skip Madagascar in August.
There you go. How fun and how interesting. By the way, do you speak any other languages?
I'm learning Italian right now, trying very hard to learn Italian. But I know a little Spanish from my childhood. But
how fun. Whose book is on your nightstand right now?
Right now there is a book. I'm blocking on his name. It's a book about a botanist who works at Kew Gardens and searches the world for bizarre new plants and tries to bring them back from the brink of extinction. A lovely book that I picked up in the UK, and he has a Spanish name, but I'm blocking on it right now.
Is this fiction or nonfiction?
Oh, it's nonfiction. It's funny.
Lovely.
Most of my leisure reading tends to be nonfiction.
How interesting. That's wonderful. I mean, that's terrific. I love hearing that. Tell me, what's your favorite research tool? Is Google your friend, or do you want to walk in the footsteps of your character?
I do both. Google is the beginning, or let's say Wikipedia is the beginning. If I have a question, for instance, I always go back to my book Gravity, which was about the space program, because that was the most research heavy thing. And I started off with, first of all, Amazon.com, buying every book I could find about astronaut training, and then I used Google, and then I ended up at Houston, at the Johnson Space Center. So it's my philosophy that you start off reading as much as you can about a topic before you approach the real life experts, because you want to go there already knowing what it is you want to ask.
The basics. Sure,
yeah.
That makes sense. Now, with Google and Wiki and Amazon and all those, you could almost get bogged down in just doing research. So you kind of have to know when to say when. Isn't that true?
That's true, because research can be – I mean, you can get completely lost in the research. You could spend years doing research on a book and never get down to the writing.
There you go. Are you a disciplined writer, Tess? When you sit down to write, do you put yourself in your – and I'm saying quotes – office and you work a certain number of hours or words. What is your process like?
It's getting less disciplined as the years go by. I'm very distractible. I mean, if there's something happening on the news, I've got TV on and I'm watching CNN. So, I think my process is that I always want to finish the book, and once I get something started, I know I will finish it. But it may take, you know, months, or it may take a year or two. But definitely, I will finish whatever I start.
Are you telling me you're easily distracted by bright, shiny objects when they pass your face?
Yes. Especially bright, shiny objects that show up on Twitter.
There you go. Oh, well, that's nice to know. Well, my final question to you is, Tess, what is something we would be surprised to learn about you?
Oh, you know, I don't have that many surprises, unless it's that if I could be anything else but a writer, I would love to be an archaeologist, I suppose, or a botanist. Those are the two things.
Oh, how fascinating. Wonderful. Tess Garrison, you're an absolute joy to speak to. I hope you have fun on your Barcelona trip, and I'll be anxiously awaiting your next book. Will you come back again, please?
I sure will, and it'll be interesting to talk about ghosts next time.
I think so, too. And, you know, writing in kind of different genres or maybe subgenres is so funny. Do you remember when we used to go into bookstore? It was like mystery, self-help, and nonfiction. Or book, you know,
right.
Fiction, nonfiction, and self-help. And I think with the advent of Amazon kind of subgenreing everything out, you kind of feel like, well, you're just no longer writing fiction. You are now have to put yourself in some odd category, and it's really too bad. Because good
it's
writing is good writing. It really is. But on the other hand, we have kind of an embarrassment of riches, those of us who love to read, correct?
That's right.
Well, I wish you and your family a lovely holiday season and a joyous new year filled with all the things you want. And I look forward to talking to you again when the next book is out.
Thank you. And you have a great holiday season, too.
Thanks, Tess. Good night.
Good night.
And that's our show for tonight. I want to remind you that this podcast is sponsored by Authors on the Air Press, presenting Betrayed, the Anthology. You will find it in all the platforms, all ebook and print platforms. Just log in with Betrayed Anthology. And thanks for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Have a great night, everyone, and I'll see you soon.